Hello, everybody. It's the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. I'm glad you're here. It's good to see you. Let's talk about some stuff. I want you to picture some sort of beach studded with shells and stones and weird, sea creatures. Hopefully not whales beached up or anything. But across this waterway, there's another beach, and you can see across to it, and it's like, it's just enough distance that you can't quite swim on your own volition. You can't quite build something with the material that you have around you. So the only thing that you're capable of doing at this moment is sitting down and looking across and admiring the other side and thinking about it a lot and really wishing you were there, even though you don't really know what the other side is or what it even is like. So the whole machination is just a fantasizing. But imagine one day a boatman comes and starts yelling at you like, "Hey, you there, like over there, you sitting there, did you know that, come here, did you know I can take you across to the other side of this waterway?" And you've been sitting there for so long and you are just excited beyond belief just to have this opportunity when somebody offers to pick you up and take you there, you know. We have to put trust in this person to get you across. So you get on, and what's weird is over time you realize that the boat just keeps going to the middle and then going back, and it never quite goes across. And eventually, one day, you might get across to the other side. But once you finally get to the other side, when you look across again, there's nothing there on the other side anymore from where you were, you left. From where you had left, there's nothing. So I found this parable sort of interesting. And what it really is looking at Buddhism. It's a metaphor for Buddhism, is how it was interpreted to me when I heard it. And there's many more than just two. There's many different countries that practice Buddhism, and the global nature and the way that any spirituality exists and evolves means that each culture takes it as its own, you know. But very generically and very broadly, and I'm no expert, so you can take this as you will, there's my Mahayana Buddhism and Hinayana Buddhism, where Mahayana, I think, is very close connected to the Siddhartha, where Buddha tried to teach people that they had to become like him and they could awaken themselves. And in that way, the key to any person's spirituality is always looking inward, because we are the own helmsman to our ship, the own driver of our car, per se. We're the one in charge of our own mind. And so when it comes to becoming a Buddha or Bodhisattva, when you're trying to help others through service, you know, that requires an inward looking. Whereas I guess the metaphor here is the boatman is whatever method you are using. And the person who I had written this from, and I can't even remember where I had heard this, so I apologize, but I still feel like the metaphor is open enough that it's common ground. With Hinayana, usually it's a lot more about asceticism, and there's more monasticism, so a lot more bureaucracy, really, where you have hierarchy, and the main idea is you're trying to beat the ego out, and you do that by beating it into submission. And to get the ego to submit, you do that by starving it first, so you don't let any desire have anything. And I guess some other schools of thought of a little bit more kinder intent, the way that I saw it at least, found that you look inward, and instead of having a little boat, which is the Hinayana, you have a big boat, which is Mahayana. And so the big boat is literally the world and how we have access to the world as a teacher, and how we can look at everything as divine in that way, if you would. You can look at everything as a reason to grow and to look for some sort of encouragement to better ourselves to whatever degree that inward look as processed is a better direction, you know, because I have a tremendous faith in the individual and the spark within everybody. And I think some people are hurt and things just happen to happen to some, but I still have faith that everyone has this goodwill per se. I guess I'm just an optimist. But so you can use the big boat or you can look for a teacher, you know, and in this frame of reference, I would also consider the small boat, the Hinayana, also to be the psychedelic method. Many have been shooken by the psychedelic state of mind. And the more that I think about it, the less and less that I think it's an accident, you know, and I think all life is influenced by it. You know, chemicals such as psilocybin are also used in cordyceps mushrooms to infest locusts. And I think it's like they can use these things to like mind control many other different species of insects too, with a little bit of coercion, you know, but it's not just humans that seem to react to these things, and it's always in different ways that, but whether or not it's an accident, human beings' subjective experience of these psychedelic state of minds, you know, it's, I was recently comparing it to almost like a cheat code, you know, where you can cheat, put a cheat code in life for a second. And I can really, when people don't know what they're experiencing either, you know, like these very useful tools can scare the shit out of you and overwhelm a person's ego or frame of mind or frame of self or whatever attachment between the self and the world they have, you know? And that experience can be so illusionary and dissolving and uncomfortable that nothing can be shaken out of it. And in that point, it's like a killing spree where the cops end up killing you in Grand Theft Auto. And it's like, what was the point of that? You know, that's almost useless. And it, like, I would much rather have pragmatic value and pull a moral out of it at the least. But no matter what you do, there's no way to stay at that state of mind and that ability to process any sort of information. And whatever method you're using to get to an altered frame, you know, at the end of the day, you have to pull a moral out of it and figure out what direction the world is teaching, you know, because I've been leaning really heavy into forming a relationship with this world and this reality that I happen to be in and inhabit, and the duties that I'm doing. Like, I have to go to work, I have to pay bills, I'm taking care, and I find that it is important to sustain the relationships that I have in my life, such as with my friends and my family. And all of that takes conscious attention. And those duties are the best way to learn how to be a better me, because that's every opportunity I have to do that the best that I can. You know, I can, when I'm at work, I can work the best I can. I can be the best person with the people that I interact with, and I can try to be the best father that I can be. And that in itself can be a spiritual practice, you know, and doing it with a smile on your face and trying to uplift those around you and always being sincere and honest, I think that reeks of right action and right words and all the other rites that the Buddha had that I can't remember right now. You can look them up. It's called the Eightfold Path, and there's eight rites. You have right action, right words, right speech, not words, right speech, right livelihood, whatever. But I think that the little boat can also have this blend. You can live your Buddhahood as much as you can in the moment and live presently the best. But I have also found great value in reading my books and my texts and my wisdom texts, like the Tao Te Ching and the Bhagavad Gita, and even the books of war, like the Torah and the Old Testament of the Bible. You know, like a lot of these old texts that I've been looking at, ancient humans and how we've been thinking for centuries and thousands of years, and relating to that and finding the words of people who've been long dead, very powerful and potent, and being able to turn that into some real world help, like Marcus Aurelius, the philosopher king in Stoicism, and Zeno. There's so many like specific schools of thought and teachers that I've been able to learn from, and so many of them conflict with one another that it's impossible for any one person to be right, which is where the world comes into play. But, you know, it's constantly being aware of what others are doing as well, because as soon as you depend upon another's worldview, another's prescription, you know, that's the little boat in a way, I think, you know, because we're not looking inwards but outwards. But I think we need to be omnipresent and have eyes on the back of our heads and look inwards and outwards at the same time. And I don't think it's impossible, even if it sounds logically impossible. If you think about it, we can stay present of what's going on and not be ruled by either, and stay in the middle ground at the central spoke of the wheel of life, or what the Buddha would call dharma, which is a spiritual duty. You know, work has been great. I've been surviving, and me and Odin finally got our apartment. We're going to be moving into an apartment starting next month, March 9th. Unfortunately, Odin is not going to be on the end of this podcast, because we have been doing a lot of work and stuff, and tonight is Thursday evening, and I have to get this up and running tomorrow, so there's no way little man's going to be able to do it. But we'll have him back next weekend, and I hope you look forward to his tremendous insight as much as I do. He's going to have his own room again, and this is the first time that I've lived alone, like completely alone, like without roommates, you know, without friends, since before I had custody of my son. And it's crazy just how much has changed in the past 6 years, and how different everything is, and how if 6 years ago I could see where I am right now, it's just amazing, and I'm so grateful. You know, I've just been constantly telling the world how grateful I am, you know, for just this tremendous boon that I feel, everything that's happened, and even all the struggle and all the hardships that have been encumbering upon my shoulders, have been so enlightening, and, you know, and have put us where we are. You know, for instance, Odin's been having struggles again, with school, which is okay. Every kid has struggles, and he's just a 6-year-old boy, and we're figuring it out. But I've mishandled disciplinary actions when having to pick him up from places before in the past. And when I had to leave work to go get him a couple days ago, I felt the routine ball drop within my stomach and the butterflies of anxiety. And my mind immediately began racing over every potential threat that could have happened and all the things that I would have to do over the next 2 weeks. And it's just insane how in 10 or 15 minutes time, how many different trails and paths of disarray and fear my mind just dwelled up and built. And what I realized, or what I didn't even realize, but what kept creeping up from the back of my head as I was driving was just this calming presence of just, you know, you have no idea what's going to happen. You're just driving. Look at that bumper plate and look at that license plate right in front. This is all that's happening. When you get there, you'll figure it out. You know, the one thing I knew that I could not do was overreact or show any sort of loss of composure. And that all I could do was just, you know, even if I couldn't talk to him for a little bit, you know, we were going to figure this out. And I got into the school and he was calm, as he usually does. He calms down very quickly. His temper changes tides immediately. And it's something that I can, that is very much me. And he either learned from me or is genetically endowed, or a mixture of both, perhaps, or of circumstance and similar circumstance, perhaps. But he was calm, and this staff at this school has been very lenient, not just lenient, but also forgiving and working with him with a huge amount of different faculty members. He's got counselors, and a lot of them are communicating with me, which is great. And they let him stay. And even though I had to leave work, they let him stay. And he got to finish out strong, which is good. And he's been having rough days still, but I have been trying to maintain this calm exterior and continuing to show him love. And what was the best part, though, was when we got home, I didn't talk to him, and I couldn't at that moment. And so he didn't want to get out of the car, and so I didn't fight him. I wasn't going to do it. And so I just walked inside, and it probably took about 5 or 6 minutes to come inside. But then he came inside and was pretty mad for a little bit. And then I took a shower. And then when I was getting out of the shower, he came up to me and was already calm. And he was just like, you know what? I think that I need to think about this and this and this. And he just had all these logical things that he needed to think about, what was going on and the things that, and either he was repeating what I had told him, or I have instilled some sort of empathy about it, because it was organic the way that he was presenting to me. And he might resent that message, but at least if he keeps saying it, eventually it will sink in, you know? And he was, at the beginning stage of considering his actions, very maturely for his age, you know, and that made me happy. And that was enough for that experience. That was enough for that, you know. And since he got to go in, you know, I couldn't go back to work because there was only like 40 minutes left in the day, you know, but it was what it was. And I got back to work, and crazily, my boss was very gentle with me, I guess, and didn't take too much from me having to leave work, which was great. And, you know, we made it through the day. And so it all worked out really well. And I looked at how my reactions were. And if I had gone in hot and been in a very different state of mind and had let my fears over future conundrums and fears of possibilities that none of it happened. He went and he finished. And the only thing I lost was like 2 hours worth of work, I think. And at the end of the day, that's $20, you know, $30 or whatever. But my son is always going to be worth far more than any amount of money, even hundreds of dollars. So it worked out very well. And he started to teach himself a lesson, which is the best thing that I could ever hope for, is for him to have that motivation intrinsically. That's that inward motivation that the Buddha was talking about, you know. But it's pretty cool to think about. I have been thinking about the scientist who decided to build a raft, and he built a raft out of some sort of like balsa wood, and he was going to go into the ocean and see where the currents took him. And crazily, the currents just took him from island to island rather easily. And he wrote about how the flying fish would fly out of the oceans and fall upon his boat. And so he'd have dinner, you know, often, and it would rain and he'd have fresh water, and like he'd get to these locations and he was able to traverse the globe, you know, and it was all just by trusting in happenstance. And that trust is the complete opposite of the fear that we instill upon any moment. And fear is natural, and fear is a teacher. And without that fear, I wouldn't have had that edge to not open my mouth as much when I was in that space. And when I got to the school, I didn't push. I didn't react. I let Odin continue doing things, and I tried not to speak against him, you know. And I trusted in the moment, and everything was okay. It's very atypical of me, you know, trusting in the balsa wood to expand and hold together better because it's wet, you know. Life is chaotic and scary, and it's crazily worth it, and it's beautiful, and we're all in it right now with a lot going on. And it's kind of cool if you just admire some of the little things that are going around you. And maybe some of those little things can be little boats, but it's still all so fantastic. And I'm so glad you're here. This week's episode's going to be a lot shorter than usual, but I'm still going to do a little bit of text reading because it's my favorite. And we're going to start with Jiddu Krishnamurti, which we haven't done in a long time. This is from his book, Think on These Things, which was published in 1964 by Krishnamurti Writings. I am not in any way making any money on this podcast. I haven't monetized or done any sort of sponsorship, and I've only spent money. This is for completely educational purposes. I hope that you do not disapprove of small portions of your fantastic writing. I think Jiddu himself might be dead for quite a few decades, but whoever might be profiting off of his name, if that person were to try to threaten me for some reason, I hope that you would notice that you're just kicking a puppy. So please don't kick the puppy. This is off page 29 from his chapter, Freedom and Love. Nope, I'm going to go back to page 28. Sorry. Do you know what it means to love somebody? Do you know what it means to love a tree or a bird or a pet animal so that you take care of it, feed it, cherish it, though it may give you nothing in return, though it may not offer you shade or follow you or depend on you? Most of us don't love in that way. We don't know what that means at all because our love is always hedged about with anxiety, jealousy, and fear, which implies that we depend inwardly on another. We want to be loved. We don't just love and leave it there, but we ask something in return. In that very asking, we become dependent. So freedom and love go together. Love is not a reaction. If I love you because you love me, that is a mere trade, a thing to be bought in the market. It is not love. To love is not to ask anything in return, not even to feel that you are giving something. And it is only such love that you can know freedom. But you see, you are not educated for this. You are educated in mathematics, in chemistry, geography, history, and there it ends, because your parents' only concern is to help you get a good job and be successful in life. If they have money, they may send you abroad, but like the rest of the world, their whole purpose is that you should be rich and have a respectable position in society. And the higher you climb, the more misery you cause for others, because to get there, you have to compete and you have to be ruthless. So parents send their children to schools where there is ambition, competition, where there is no love at all, and that is why a society such as ours is continually decaying in constant strife. And though the politicians, the judges, the so-called nobles of the land talk about peace, it does not mean a thing. Now you and I have to understand this whole problem of freedom. We must find out for ourselves what it means to love, because if we don't love, we can never be thoughtful or attentive. We can never be considerate. Do you know what it means to be considerate? When you see a sharp stone on a path trodden by many bare feet, you remove it, not because you have been asked, but because you feel for another. It does not matter who he is, and you may never meet him. To plant a tree and cherish it, to look at the river and enjoy the fullness of the earth, to observe a bird on the wing and see the beauty of its flight, to have sensitivity and be open to this extraordinary movement called life. For all this, there must be freedom, and to be free, you must love. Without love, there is no freedom. Without love, freedom is merely an idea which has no value at all. So it is only for those who understand and break away from inner dependence, and who therefore know what love is, that there can be freedom. And it is they alone who will bring about a new civilization and a different world. This man was particularly potent. He has always moved me in great ways. Jiddu Krishnamurti, please look him up. He has speeches and he has books, plenty. One of the world's precious gems. So do partake if you can, you know, and I picked this book up for $3. So, you know, there is priceless wisdom that you can find from teachers in every single direction. And what he is trying to teach here is this message of love and how you can't love when you're in fear. And how the ways that we're trying to educate now is teaching our children to compete and be fearful in such a way that we're fearful for existence because we have to compete to survive. We have to compete to eat, to get station in whatever work we're in, you know? Like, the only way that you can seek to get better is to work to death, you know? And that's not love, you know? That's not freedom. Freedom is in the moment when you give selflessly and you remove that stone off the ground that Jiddu was just talking about. When you remove the ground selflessly and you do a selfless act out of compassion and just gratitude that that other is a being of love and could is a representative of God. I heard this one Hindu proverb about how this one teacher was asked, like, and this woman was like, a woman or man was like, I can't love God enough, and I don't know how to. I can't think about what an impossible God could be. How do I even devote myself to this in such a bhakti fashion? Or bhakti is devotion, or devotion of love to God at all times. And this teacher said, you know, do you have a son at home? And she was like, yes. And she was like, that son is God. You know, you go there and you devote yourself fully to them, and you are devoting yourself to God. Because every single entity and creature and every human around you that is easily accessible, more accessible than a wild animal, you know, like, that you can go interact with and show selfless compassion and love, that's pure devotion in almost a religious fashion, if you can just love selflessly. And I'm not sure I always can, or if what I'm doing is what other people even consider to be compassionate, but I think it's compassionate because I'm trying to give to others, you see. And that's out of love. That's me trying to remove stones out of people's ways, you know? And I don't want anything for it. All right. So, of course, I always like to do the random Tao verse. So should we do the end of the Tao or the beginning of the Tao? Just like a shuffle of the deck. Let's see here. I think I've done that one. I'm thinking 40-something. 47 sounds good. Nope, I've done that one. Okay, 46. When the way is at hand in the world, running horses are led back to the field to create manure. When the way is not in the world, generations of horses are born within the borders of the state. There is no disaster greater than not knowing what is enough. There is no fault greater than wanting to obtain more. Thus, the sufficiency of knowing what is sufficient is unchangingly sufficient. When you know when you've had enough, and you can stay in that enoughness, it's a lot more comfortable than striving. And I always like the horse analogy. So when we're not following the way, the horses could also be like our thoughts. And that's when they're breeding war. You know, generations are born at war. Whereas when they're not at war, we have fertile horses, which are led back to the field to create this manure. And for me, this metaphor tonight is hitting as like fertile creativity and fertile ability, you know, which is lucky sometimes. Let's do a 30. I'm thinking 33. He who knows others may have knowledge enough to predict the rain, but he who knows himself will see with the clarity of the sun and the moon. He who is victorious over others has strength, but he who is victorious over himself will have the potency of a swarm of bees. He who knows how to stop with what is sufficient is rich with his own house and fields. He who puts one foot in front of the other with strength will have resolution. He who does not lose his place will stay long. But he who dies but is not forgotten will be long lived. And that last line, you know, that's what my ego is attached to. My ego wants to put something down. Eventually I will write, but this is a little piece of me. You know, if you're listening right now, you know, I am speaking wholeheartedly right to you. And I want you to know that you are a very important personhood. You're a very important self, and you are special, and you were put on this place because in all aspects, within some people's religious outlook, you are God, you know. So you can look inward and trust in yourself and your own ability sometimes, and, you know, use that trust to motivate towards a growth, which takes work and takes an action, but not a forceful action, not where you're trying to strive against what you can do or strive against others to step upon them. You know, but that specialness is innately within you. And even if you're using psychedelics as a route, whatever the psychedelics unlock in you, that is you. You are special, and that is what you are feeling is your raw power. But you don't need any sort of tool or any sort of anything to be. And at some point, you can just find that space within you. And I'm starting to feel it within me, you know. And whether it's woohoo and whether it's just blood flow or some sort of potassium ion and sodium ion interplay within the nervous fibers of my peripheral cortex, and whether it's material or whether it's majestic and whether it's outward bound or whether it's alien or whether we're all just stoned apes. Either way, I'm so glad to be here in it with you. And I'm so thankful and I'm so grateful that you're in it with me. So thank you so much for signing in. The Gingerbread Man is signing out this week. See you next week.